Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the curious state of cultural criticism.
And we'll hear about a coming-of-age novel with a magical twist.
But first, one of Claire Gear's earliest memories is spitting fish sticks into a cup. But she was not sitting in a high chair at her parents' dining room table. She was on the set of a TV commercial. In fact, a lot of Gear's formative memories took place on sets. When she was 5 years old, Sarah Paulson shoved her. When she was 8, Owen Wilson threw her off a roof. Don't worry, it was in the script. That last example comes from the movie No Escape, which also starred Pierce Brosnan. Here is 8-year-old Claire Gear on an airplane talking to Brosnan's character in an early scene from the film.
How are you?
Good. What happened to your hand?
Got in a fight with a tiger.
Really?
Really. Don't worry, though. You got it worse than I did.
What happened to your head?
Fell down a flight of stairs in Hong Kong.
Okay. Honey, come on, sit down. Don't bother him. Okay.
These days, Gear isn't running lines with former James Bond actors. She's an ASU student, studying journalism, working in a cafe to make ends meet. And while acting once defined her life, lately, she's been focused on defining herself. Not long ago, Gear published an essay in State Press magazine called Forever Famous, The Life of a Former Child Actress and Current Wannabe. When Gear thinks about the future, she doesn't picture her face on movie posters. She pictures bylines like the one that accompanied that State Press essay. Claire Gear wants to be a writer. As she told me recently, she loved being a child star, but it wasn't something she chose. And when it comes to writing, it's a very different story.
Writing is like the biggest choice I've made in my life. You really have to consciously do it. I mean, you have to consciously act too, but for me it was a little unconscious. So choosing to put time into it when it wasn't a job, it wasn't something that I just did every day waking up, that was the big difference for me.
I mean, we're here talking because you wrote this piece that was extremely personal and really revealing about yourself and your inner life, how you think about yourself in the world. I think sharing oneself in that way is a reason that a lot of people act. But is it fair to say that you get that more from writing?
I think so. Because when you're acting, you are like sharing a piece of yourself, but you're sharing it through some sort of character or some sort of scene. But when I write, I'm able to write just like as me, from me.
What do you like about that feeling of laying it all out there?
Ooh, that's a good question. Part of me is not sure. I think it's cathartic. Maybe it's even selfish because I'll write these pieces and then I'll feel at peace with myself about a certain scenario or a happening in my life.
I mean, that's a very beautiful feeling, the sense of being at peace with yourself. But just to offer, I mean, I think something that I was very drawn to about your piece, beyond the specific, you know, details, is this sense that you have lived a journey that I think a lot of people view as the goal. And implied in what you wrote is this idea that that's not enough. Like, there has to be more. I think that's a pretty provocative idea, just the sense that there is something more powerful to you about the experience of writing, say, this essay than seeing your face on a movie poster.
Definitely. Part of it doesn't feel real. Part of my acting and my being on billboards and all that stuff, the brief time where I was sort of quote-unquote famous, part of that feels sort of like a fever dream. I guess this sounds kind of bad, but it is like achievable. But what does that mean necessarily?
No, that makes sense, though. I mean, the idea that there's a difference between success and purpose is also rather provocative, I think. What would you say the sense of purpose that you find through writing is?
I mean, basically, some of the stuff I write, it feels like a diary entry.
Uh-huh.
And I've gotten, you know, feedback, or I've had people reach out, and that's just like the best feeling in the world to me, is being able to feel like I was able to relate to people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the really compelling quotes from your piece for me was, "It hurts to have a public image from as far back as that age, and sometimes I feel like it hurts to have one at this age, too." Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
I have a lot of work out there from being a child actress to now writing. I mean, I mentioned my, like, high school newspaper. I even have stuff out there from that, which I fear is regrettable sometimes.
Can you give me an example?
I've always been a satirist. So I wrote a couple of satires my high school days that sort of just reeked of, like, disdain for my own high school. And I read it back and I was like, geez, it's like these people must have hated me. Like, uh-huh. I was going at them.
Mm-hmm.
Or even just, I wrote some news stories that I just feel have, like, not very nuanced takes attached to them because I was so young, which I hate to have that out there.
Right. Yes, that makes total sense. That makes total sense. But it's interesting to me, I have to say, Claire, that I think some people have the experience of realizing how exposing it is to write something in your own voice that either you look back on and kind of cringe, or maybe you get negative feedback to it. And that's enough for a lot of people to stop writing. But it has not stopped you. So tell me about that.
Jeez. I mean, yeah, it hasn't stopped me, which is...
Nor should it. Nor should it. I don't mean that.
Thank you. I think for me it's just that feeling, like I said earlier, kind of like when I write this sort of stuff, I feel some sort of peace within myself, or I feel some sort of closure happening in some way, even if it's just closure on, like, an idea, mm-hmm. like a satire.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling is just so powerful that I don't think I could ever stop writing,
mm-hmm.
even though it's scary to me to put out work that I might change my mind on, you know, a year later.
Do you think there is any connection between your experience as an actor and your ability to have that perspective that you just articulated?
I think everything in my life goes back to my formative acting days. I guess it teaches you that you can be picked apart for anything. And so it might as well, in my mind, be something that I at least at one point thought or felt. It might as well be on my terms. I almost like writing and imagining someone reading and being able to imagine me, like, behind my computer writing it.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of what I hope to achieve when I write, is that someone could, like, feel me doing it. And so to have yourself in every bit of a piece, even when you are playing a character, like in a satire, that is definitely different than when you act and you're supposed to leave no trace.
Right. In the version you're doing now, you get to act without having to disappear.
That's true. That's a very cool way to put it.
Well, Claire Gear is a writer and an ASU student and a former child actor. Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we'll hear from an author about her latest magical coming-of-age novel.
But first, is cultural criticism dead? The show's longtime culture critic wants to know. In the latest episode of KJZZ's podcast, State of the Arts, Robert Pala looks at the role of the people who make a living by exploring meaning in what we create and consume, like films, art, food, even podcasts. They're curious guides whose objectivity and skill can help the rest of us decide what is worth our time and money. And there aren't many of them left, Pala explains.
I've worked as a writer, a journalist, for most of my adult life. I'm 62, and I like to think I do what I can to stay current, not to be that old guy who's always talking about the good old days when things were different and therefore better. So I struggle with things like the topic of this podcast, something I find myself referring to as the death of cultural criticism. I don't want to be an old fogey about it, but it's not easy to watch as informed critical thinkers, people who make their living as expert voices on a particular topic, are replaced by people who are less interested in commentary and more interested in promoting their brand, whatever that may be. It wasn't that long ago that critics, people who did what I used to do for a living, were expected to know well the medium they were reviewing. We also needed to use our critical thinking skills to analyze what we were looking at with objectivity. Our editors relied on us to know which movie to see or which restaurant to eat at. We were expected to know whether the leading lady was properly cast and well directed, whether adding pancetta to carrot cake was a good idea. Readers put their faith in us, knowing we'd been writing about this subject for a long while and looking to us to tell them whether they should buy the new Anne Tyler novel or not. The people who made the art or the food we were writing about counted on us to inform the community that they were there. This new steakhouse is open and not very good, I might have told people when I was a restaurant critic. Don't miss this new anthology, edited by Michael Thomas Ford, I might have said when I was a books critic. Don't go see Nearly Naked Theater's production of Night of the Iguana, I once said, back when I was a theater critic. And then I told you why. So did a lot of others. When I reviewed theater for the City Weekly, there were seven of us doing that job. Betty Webb from the Scottsdale Progress, Pauline Yearwood at the Jewish News, Chris Curcio and Kyle Lawson of the Arizona Republic, the Mesa Tribune's Max McQueen, Phoenix Gazette columnist Christopher McPherson. Later there was Michelle Hoffman and Carrie Lengel, both at the Republic. We were print journalists, which is to say we were a dying breed, though back then we didn't know it. Looking back, I wonder, did we really work as full-time critics? Did people actually care what we had to say? In the new world, most of us get headlines and opinions from social media. So are cultural critics necessary? And has anyone even noticed that most of us are gone? Phoenix New Times, the City Weekly, where for 30 years I wrote cultural criticism, publishes no theater, restaurant, or visual arts criticism today. Nor do the publications that make up the East Valley Tribune chain. The news isn't all bad. Bill Goodykoontz writes TV and movie criticism for the Arizona Republic, where Andy Berlin covers restaurants and Ed Masley reviews popular music.
My favorite albums, my favorite bands, I was introduced to by critics who were able to place them in a context that when I read it, I thought, oh, well, this is for me.
That's Ed. I asked him to talk to me about whether he thought critical thinking was dying.
I think there are critics out there with followings who are respected, who people will take a chance on a record because of their work. Yeah, I think they do exist. Hmm. I think it's getting harder to make a career out of it, right. You know? But I would think that if Ann Powers says that, like, a record is good, a lot of people are going to give that record a chance. It's going to be because of the way, A, because of her name, but B, because of the way she writes about it. Like, she's compelling. You know, she's
right.
She makes her points very well. And if you read something, it makes you want to give it consideration. I think there are writers out there who are like that.
These days, critics have gone the way of the 8-track tape and dial-up internet. We've been replaced mostly by bloggers who act as their own editors and are sometimes even involved in the industry they're reviewing, and by social media influencers, a new means of covering the arts that has very little to do with criticism. Restaurant owners pay influencers to rave about their food, while theater companies have taken to asking for online reviews from audience members. All of this blurs the line between this sort of faux criticism and the real thing. One by one, I've watched critical thinkers disappear from journalism, either because the paper they wrote for folded, or their column got canceled because, well, arts coverage is always the first thing to go. The how and why of all this is old news. As we shift from print to online media, advertisers are spending less on traditional publications. As a result, publishers cut page counts and trim staffs. An industry that used to belong to arbiters and editors belongs today to accountants. A good accountant is concerned about money, not deep thinking about culture. They want more clicks, more page views, because these lead to revenue.
I think it enters into the decision-making process. I don't think it's the only factor. It's like I view reviewing the giant concert that's going to get a ton of page views as something that gives me leverage to write a few stories on local artists and smaller things that I think are important.
Right.
That like will be the underperforming nature of those stories will be less noticed because I can say, oh, look over there. Look at that. Look how many people read that thing about Sammy Hagar playing at Barrett Jackson. You know, that got, I want to say, a ton of page views. And so it made it very easy to experiment that week, that month, writing smaller stuff that might go nowhere.
On one hand, it's great that anyone who owns an iPhone can build an audience to whom they can express their feelings about books and movies and chimichangas. But should great cinematography be measured with likes and emojis? Should a stunning canvas be ranked by a critic who thinks pop art is maybe a kind of toaster pastry?
You know, when I like to tell people, especially on my page, a lot of people say, like, oh, I love your food reviews. And a big thing I like to drive home is I don't really consider myself necessarily as a food reviewer. My job is I'm an awareness campaign.
Chelsea Hostin is an influencer. She has an Instagram page called Let Them Eat This. And she talks mostly about restaurants that she likes or cafes that she's been to that she thinks you should go to as well.
So my entire job is to tell you this place exists. And at the end all be all, everybody has different tastes, right? So like if I haven't had Moroccan cuisine before, who am I to say like, this is the best, I know everything, you don't know anything, because somebody who grew up in that culture is going to have a better take on that than I will. And so the way I look at it is like, hey, this is, you know, this, here's this Moroccan restaurant. This is what they offer. This is where it's located. If I really like something, I might be like, oh, I tried this. This was my favorite thing on the menu. But that's using my taste and talking about it. And I try to be fair when I do videos to say what I really liked or if I didn't like something. I'm like, oh, you know, you may want to just stick with drinks at this place. Their happy hour is pretty good.
We can't blame influencers. While the world shifted to social media as a news source, the interest in criticism was already waning. When my theater column was finally canceled a few years ago, it was canceled by a 23-year-old editor who announced that no one cared about theater anymore. He meant young people, of course. He was after clicks, but he must not have gotten them. He was fired not long after. By then, I'd found something else to write about. I keep trying to convince myself that there must be something good about this move away from critical thinking and toward what amounts to paid PR flacks telling us what to like because they do. Because, I mean, what about those arts institutions that can't afford to pay an influencer to promote their product? Like an art gallery. Then again, what would that look like? An influencer promoting an art gallery or maybe a new exhibition at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. Would they pose in front of a painting and tell you how much they enjoyed what they saw? I figured Herb Payne would have something to say about all this.
I think if you're of a generation that was used to the presence of thoughtful professional critics in the newspaper business, that you do miss it.
Herb is a theater critic for an online magazine called Broadway World. He reviews local plays and musicals.
It was great to have the ability to look to a Richard Nilsson or a Kyle Lawson or a Kerry Lengel on a regular basis because the newspaper gave those individuals credibility. They were trustworthy resources for providing a perspective on the theater. Now that's been replaced by what I would call the democratization of everything. You've got people now providing their opinions about theater without any perspective or knowledge about the art itself. Arts criticism has been abandoned in the name of the monetization of information by the newspapers. And I think that's led to an unfortunate demise in critical thinking about what people are watching, that kind of gratuitous standing O at the end of a performance that seems to be, what is it, a thoughtless gesture without really considering what happened here in the last 2 hours, you know?
Do you think anyone cares that what critics used to do with some, presumably with some expertise, has been replaced by that democratized voice, as you put it, that voice of the potentially uninformed?
I think they should care. I don't know that they do care. If they're now in the habit of relying on self-expression or relying on the marketing by the theater companies, they don't know what they're missing. They may not care about what they're missing. It's like, if democracy is lost, would anyone notice? If the critic is lost, would anyone notice? That's why as a theater critic, I'm concerned not only about providing increased exposure and visibility to the art form, but to wanting to make it better. And gratuitous reviews by either audience members, which are posted on the theater company's website, or by those reviewers who feel their obligation is to the actor or the director, I think we've lost a great deal.
I wanted to know what the artists themselves thought about this shift in criticism. So I sat down with Ron May and Katie McFadden to get their take on this. Ron is an actor and the founder of Stray Cat Theater, one of our most popular local companies. Katie is an actor who these past 30 years has been an associate artist with Child's Play, a professional company of adults who make theater for children.
I think that there are theater patrons that miss reliable voices to turn to. I think there are people that miss a Sunday paper that had a voice, a professional critical voice that was talking about the arts so that they had something to engage with on a regular basis. So it depends. And it's also those, for the most part, but I mean, everyone had their favorites too, to where there were certain critics they would listen to and there are certain critics they wouldn't. And it's the same with any blogger or any Instagram, any influencer. There are those that you go, oh, okay, they like everything they see. But there were critics that were around. People said that about Kyle Lawson all the time. They were like, Kyle Lawson never hates anything. And I was like, I have categorical proof that's not true.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've noticed that one way to fill that gap has been for theaters to ask the audience to post a review. presumably they're being vetted. And I hear a lot of griping about that sort of in general, both from your side of the story and mine. But I also feel like I get it, because where else are you going to get commentary?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it also gives the theaters an opportunity to mine the better comments and the more positive ones and the sound bites and the things they can put in their emails and on their social media. And I just for the heck of it, yesterday went onto Google reviews because I'm like, what are people actually asking their audiences to post things on things like Google and Yelp? And there's tons and tons of stuff out there, depending on the company. But most of them are things like, love the venue, love this company, love the work they do. They're not like real critical.
And they're usually not on a show-by-show basis.
Right.
I can say, speaking from personal experience, Stray Cat sort of lives or dies by our audience talking about our shows.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that we've sort of, the reason that Stray Cat sort of exists is we were like sushi at the beginning. It was like you tell people, I have this plate of raw fish, and you're like, that is disgusting. Why would I want that?
Mm-hmm.
But you sort of talk to people, here are the ways to enjoy it, and you can sort of not train, but you can teach people what's good about it and hopefully encourage them to try it, and then they come back. And it's the same thing with what we have been providing since Jump. We've had to sort of teach people, like, I promise you, you're not going to know the title. You're not going to know anything about the show. But you can trust that if you come and see the work, you're going to get something out of it. So having been around as long as we have an audience that is sort of like, we know how to interact with this material, and we know how to talk about it. So they're sort of the best advocates for it, because they're the ones that are seeking it out. So they're the best ones to say, and here's why I like it. That's usually what's missing in other reviews, is a sort of critical engagement with the work. Whereas we're lucky to have, yes, there are certain people that come and go, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen. You're like, yeah, okay. But we've been really fortunate that we have people that engage, I think, on a more critical level than some critics do.
I think there's an accessibility factor too. I think that sometimes some of those old school reviews don't feel very accessible to today's audience. I think there's also like an attention span thing too. We have kind of a TikTok attention span now.
Yeah.
It's more palatable, I guess. I don't know.
The
shorter version as opposed to the long form.
Yeah. I think the feedback loop is shortened. Usually a critic, I mean, if you came and saw a show, we'd be lucky if we got a review out within a week.
Mm-hmm.
This is within 24 hours you get something. You can get something at intermission of a show, you know, which is great. And I think it's mm-hmm. important to have both voices. I think it's important to have the new voice that goes and sees the Glass Menagerie that's never seen it before. And they engage with it and respond to it because it's a new attack. And they go, I can tell you that from not knowing the Glass Menagerie, I really enjoyed it. Because they don't know they're not supposed to. Because they weren't around 50 years ago when whoever did it on Broadway. But you have that critic also that's like, well, what you don't understand is that that's a terrible performance. She doesn't understand any of the nuance. She doesn't understand that because they're around and they saw a certain performance. And I think that those conversations are gone almost completely now.
Mm.
And I think they're vital to things. Because you also get to decide which one you want to listen to. I want to hear them all. I like hearing them all.
I'm still hopeful. There are some local critics still working here, writing critical essays that reach wider audiences. Nikki Buchanan continues to review restaurants for Phoenix Magazine. Herb Payne and Ed Masley still cover their music and theater beats. And arts writer Lynn Trimble has been publishing her work in Southwest Contemporary, a regional online publication where she writes about Arizona artists. Gil Benbrook reviews theater for PhoenixStages.com. Carrie Lengel, the former Arizona Republic theater critic, has launched a YouTube channel where he offers something called This Is Not a Review. It's a video series that promotes local theater arts. And I've been fortunate. Phoenix Magazine, the local city monthly, offered me an opinion column writing about local culture. And KJZZ, the local National Public Radio member station, continues to air my thoughts and opinions on the arts. I don't want to be sentimental about the bygone days of arts criticism. I keep reminding myself that the new generation of consumers, the new generation of readers, won't miss what they don't know. If you grow up on likes and page views and whatever's viral on Instagram, you're not going to miss Frank Rich's review of The Cherry Orchard in the New York Times, or what Jonathan Gold wrote about A Slice of Pie in the Los Angeles Times. Right? I'm doing my best to believe that.
That was Robert Palip. To hear the interview again and catch other episodes of State of the Arts, go to kjzz.org.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. A 13-year-old girl is preparing for her bat mitzvah, even though her family rarely goes to synagogue. At the same time, Zippy believes she's a witch. That is the premise of the latest children's novel from Laurel Snyder called The Witch of Woodland. As part of our occasional series called Lit Squad, we talk with authors of middle grade and young adult novels about their books. I spoke with Snyder a little while back, before I should mention the October 7th attack by Hamas in Israel, which led to the current war in Gaza. And I asked if the inspiration for this book came from her personal experience.
This book came out of the fact that I was parenting through the bar mitzvah process. Both my boys, I have boys who are 16 and 17 now, and they both in sort of quick succession went through this experience, and I was very aware of how different it was for them and how I wanted it to be different for them than it was for me.
And in terms of sort of the supernatural aspect of it, I mean, the book is called The Witch of Woodland. Like, where did that come from?
I was a big believer in magic as a child. I'm somebody who, and to some degree, I still am a big believer in magic. But I was a kid who struggled a lot in these years myself and kind of looked for amazing things in the world around me. And then I had a very specific experience when I was in fifth or sixth grade, where another older girl apprenticed me to become a witch. So I think, as is often the case with novels, so many things get pulled into it that this book is a mixture of my thinking about religious ideas and my own culture and the moment we're in, but also reaching back into my childhood memories for things that felt really powerful or confusing or in some cases upsetting when I was a kid too.
Yeah. Well, so you talk about being in the moment and doing the math here. If my math is correct, at least one of your sons would have been going through the bar mitzvah process during COVID, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So we had one go through right before and then one get stuck. So he would have had his bar mitzvah in June of 2020. Mm. And it was pretty intense. I remember calling my father when everything was starting to shut down to talk about how we'd have to rethink the bar mitzvah. And he said to me, "Laurel, you're not going to have a bar mitzvah. It will be 2 to 4 years for a vaccine."
Wow.
In March, he said this.
Huh.
Yeah, it was intense.
Well, I guess he was partially right, right? I mean, it was not 2 to 4 years for the vaccine, but I'm guessing you did not have the bar mitzvah, at least the one that you had been planning to have.
Correct, yeah. So we initially, the synagogue really, they did a wonderful, wonderful job, but everybody was so challenged by that moment. And so we had been planning one kind of bar mitzvah. And what ended up happening was that we rented an Airbnb in the neighborhood with a swimming pool so that my kid could sort of have a nice evening, and ordered some takeout and gave him a talis and read did the usual prayers for Friday night as a family. And that was his bar mitzvah. Mm. And then this sort of, I think probably a lot of people had similar experiences. And then everybody kept sort of expecting things were going to come back to normal and kicking the can down the road. And so what we ended up doing at the very last minute was moving everything to my front yard and backyard. We sort of rented a tent and a bunch of chairs at the last minute when Delta hit, and moved the party to our yard. So it was a very impromptu DIY kind of bar mitzvah.
Did any of that find its way into the book?
Yes, certainly. Certainly the pandemic affected the book, but I'm not sure that it affected it so much in direct content as that I thought I knew what the book was going to be, in the same way that we all thought we knew what lots of things were, and then the pandemic changed those understandings. And so I thought I knew what the book was going to be. I had it all planned out. I had the bar mitzvah all planned out. Life was all planned out. And then everything went up in the air. And the book ended up coming out like 2 years late. And a big part of that was that my well-laid plan didn't work anymore. And the way I was thinking about it was different. The way my kids were responding was different. And some of that uncertainty and the sort of lessons of the pandemic, I think, came into the book as ideas in ways that are more sort of overt than I might have otherwise had them.
Yeah.
But uncertainty is an idea in the book. And being comfortable with that feeling, learning to be comfortable with things not being perfect or fixed or worked out.
Well, I would think the idea of unpredictability and maybe being a little uncomfortable with things is something that a lot of your readers could probably relate to based on where they are in their lives.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That and I think it's one of the dangers of writing. And probably this is true in radio also, right? If you think you know the point you have to make before you've done the work of getting there, you're probably not right.
Yeah.
And so sort of when you think you have something well laid for a book, I think often you haven't done enough discovery yet. Like you haven't figured out what the accidents are going to be. And I think that then sort of was replicated in the book. And I think that is something that kids this age, particularly middle school kids, go through, that we as parents want so badly to make their lives sort of fine or good or comfortable. And being 12 or 13 is just an age of discomfort for so many kids. And learning to accept that reality and to sort of say, I can't fix this. I can't control this. There's nothing's going to make this quite right. And also I'm going to wake up tomorrow and have tomorrow. And things will be better down the road in a way that I can't even anticipate. But that doesn't mean that I can fix this right now.
Right. Well, I wonder if maybe the magic aspect comes in a little bit there as well, because, you know, a lot of times when people feel out of control or, you know, that something is just really too hard for them, the idea of, you know, I know this is not exactly what your character is doing, but, you know, the ability to wave a magic wand and make everything better can be really appealing. So I wonder if there's an aspect of that sort of fits into all what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I feel like that was sort of the underlying thing for me in this book is that Zippy, this is a book about a girl who is simultaneously Jewish and preparing for bat mitzvah and also believes herself to be a witch and works really, really hard to kind of control the world around her. And she does this in a number of ways, but the main way she does this is magic. The reason that spells and magic feel so satisfying to her is that she is trying to manage her life. She is trying to manage the things she has no control over. And I think a lot of us do that in this world. We do that with diet. We do that with exercise. We do that with schoolwork. We do that with, I mean, all kinds of ways. And I think what Zippy has to learn, both in terms of her daily life and in terms of magic, is that sometimes you have to relinquish that power, that control. Sometimes it isn't about control, but that doesn't mean it's not also useful and worthwhile.
Do you see this book in some ways as maybe a helpful guide for teenagers who are maybe struggling with some of these issues in terms of understanding who they are or what they believe or sort of where they fit into the world or even where they fit into their family or their community?
I really, really hope so. Those of us who write for this age, it's a funny thing because we're speaking a language we don't actually speak fluently anymore. You know, you're reaching back for memory and you're looking at the kids today and you're trying to find a way to make something that will be meaningful and useful. You know, the specifics are different, right? Zippy's story is not anybody else's story. But I really hope that the kids who read this book sort of, because they're not Zippy, they can sort of see her as a mirror. But yeah, I mean, I think all humans wrestle with these questions. And I think that there are certain moments in childhood where it's more acute or newer or you know, your emotions are kind of out of control and you're processing it in a louder way. But I'm not sure that adults, I mean, I hear from adults about children's books too. I think that a lot of adults find these things also useful.
Laurel Snyder is the author of children's novels. Her most recent is called The Witch of Woodland. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Jason Patrick Woodbury is a longtime fixture in the Arizona music scene. Today, he's creative director at Hello Merch and host of two music podcasts, Wastoids and Transmissions, for the online music magazine Aquarium Drunkard. And he's a musician himself. He spoke with our co-host Lauren Gilger last year, and he brought us a Christmas playlist full of songs you probably haven't heard a million times already, at least not in these forms. Here's their conversation.
I like Christmas. Like, I genuinely do. I think it's a very sweet time of year, and it's a very special time, if you let it be. And of course, there are a million crazy things happening in the world that make it feel, you know, not Christmassy, or you might even feel guilty for indulging the coziness of the of the season. But no, I do like it, and I like Christmas music because I think Christmas music at its heart is, like, often just very well-written music. There's a certain kind of classic form that you aspire to. But I also think that Christmas is a holiday that has space for a lot of different emotional feelings. And so I like music that, I like sad Christmas music, you know, and sweet Christmas music and fun Christmas music, but also a little out there Christmas. But yeah, I think Christmas music is, it gets a bad rap and it gets a little overplayed, I'm sure. But that's why we tried to find some songs that maybe you haven't heard a million times.
Right. Okay. But I mean, some of these are covers, like almost all Christmas music
is, but
not the first one on your list. Tell us about this one. This is by The Free Design.
Yeah. So The Free Design was a family vocal group from Delavan, New York, and they recorded in the late 60s and early 70s. And they had this kind of jazzy sound that record collectors call sunshine pop. As you can imagine, sunshine pop lends itself well to Christmas. This is from a 1968 single that they put out. It has another Christmas song on the B-side, Christmas is the Day, and that one's okay. But but this one, Close Your Mouth, It's Christmas, it's really good.
Close your mouth except to say, might get something happening. This season has a secret joy that's all I'm missing.
What I like about it is really that it's kind of an anti-consumerist song. It's like a song about locating something about the season that runs a little deeper than just your shopping list. And I feel like that's really nice. There's this line in it where one of the singers sings, get to know the people in your house. You might like them. And you might like them. It's, you know, who knows?
Get to know the people in your house. You might like them.
But it's sweet and it's funny and it's kind of a cutesy song. But I also think that it's a reminder that if you go into things with the right spirit, you might actually end up seeing the good in people, because it's there, most of the time at least, if you look close enough.
Most of the time. There's no more Christmassy message than that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's move on to something a little different. This is by Jessie Mae Hemphill.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas, Pretty Baby, a song we know, but this does not sound like a regular kind of cover of a Christmas song.
No, and this is one that I think I probably heard on KJZZ's Those Lowdown Blues with Bob Corator. Sunday evening listening forever, right? Bob's been doing that for as long as I have been alive, I believe, literally. I think this is one that I heard and it just got stuck in my head. Jessie Mae Hemphill is a singer who came up in the North Mississippi blues scene, and they have like this really fertile ground there where all sorts of blues icons have emerged from that territory, including her grandfather, Sid Hemphill, who was recorded on a bunch of Alan Lomax recordings. Mm. But what I love about this one is that Jessie is playing it all. It's a one-woman band.
Eh.
So she sings, plays guitar, and hits a tambourine. Then she doubled back and added snare and bass. But, you know, for me, so much Christmas music ends up being very well-mannered and very on the nose. I think what I like about what Jessie does with this song is that it's full of imperfections and ragged edges, and it ends up just creating this sort of hypnotic but very, very human feel. And I think it sounds especially good after a few strong glasses of eggnog. So,
yes, which I hope we'll all be having soon. Okay, so this next song is by a band we all probably know, My Morning Jacket, Jim James, right?
Yeah.
Our World.
Love can open your eyes in our sunrise.
Well, so I've been listening to My Morning Jacket forever, 20 years even. I think I was reflecting on it and realized that I got their 2003 album, It Still Moves, for Christmas that year.
Full circle over there.
Thanks, Dad. But yeah, they're from Louisville, Kentucky, and they're led by Jim James. But this is a cover. It's written by the great songwriter Paul Williams. Mm. And it's one of the songs that's featured in one of my... Everybody has, like, the Christmas movies they have to watch every year.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, the Jim Henson...
I've never even heard of this.
You don't know Emmett Otter? Okay, get ready. You're about to lose it because it is so, so good. It's the perfect blend of sweet and melancholy and warm and goofy, and it's really incredible. And, of course, it's all... these beautiful little
Muppets.
It's characters who are mostly mostly just in this movie, but okay. I think Kermit D. Frog does show up in the very beginning.
He's on the cover for this song, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And well, and this came from this cool comp where a bunch of people covered Muppets associated songs.
Cool.
So it's kind of weird. It might not necessarily scan as a Christmas song lyrically, but because it's featured in that movie, which is just so good, it's a story, I think, a movie about these characters that put others before themselves. And I think Jim James really gets to that with this song and sings these really beautiful lines about how the world feels too small, but there's room for everybody.
I say with kindness, there's room for us all.
And I think that if that's a maybe slightly countercultural Christmas message, that I think we could all take to heart.
Yeah, that's lovely. Okay, so the next song on the list is Frosty the Snowman, which we all know, obviously. But this does not sound like the Frosty the Snowman you probably think of.
Probably not. Yeah, this is the Cocteau Twins. Are goths allowed to do Christmas? That's the question I had. I don't know.
Everyone's allowed to do Christmas. Come on.
Well, if so, I think the Cocteau Twins bring the Yuletide spirit to their kind of gothy sensibility. But yeah, Cocteau Twins are this Scottish dream pop trio comprising Robin Guthrie, Simon Raymond, and Elizabeth Fraser. And she's one of my favorite singers of all time. So often the Cocteau Twins don't really sing in what we would categorize as English, but they're not singing in any other language either. It's just sort of gibberish, you know, sort of a, I don't know, a kind of secular glossolalia, which is that term for when you're speaking in tongues or whatever.
Okay.
So she's often draped in all sorts of effects, but on this one, she is singing the traditional Frosty the Snowman lyrics. But when you hear him put in this context, this sort of post-punk context, you realize the Frosty story is weird. It's like kind of a if it's not a full-on ghost story, there's still something supernatural. Inanimate object comes to life. But, you know, traditionally, Christmas Eve is sort of a time where people would tell ghost stories.
Yeah,
it's
about you hear references to that in old Christmas songs. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we've gotten away from that tradition. But hopefully, listening to stuff like the Cocteau Twins do Frosty the Snowman can help put us back in the slightly more somber and maybe even a little spooky Christmas Eve zone. So,
nice. Okay. And we're going to end with a duo here, a double entry, as you say. This is two different versions of one of the great kind of all-time Christmas songs, I think, which is Charlie Brown Christmas, Christmas Time is Here.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, this is as good as it gets as far as I'm concerned. I listen to the Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack an awful lot around this time of year. And these are two very different versions of it. The first is by this Texas trio, Krungbin, who are just really great. They kind of do psychedelic global music where it's part surf, part Latin vibe, part lo-fi hip-hop. And they just have this really cool thing. This would be like if Lucy Van Pelt and Charlie Brown went to Coachella. Like that, this might be how it sounds. It's a very, very down tempo, very groovy, very laid back. and that melody is impossible to beat. And that's why I really like this other version. It's a little more obscure. I don't even know if it's on all of the streaming services.
I looked on Spotify for this, and this was the only one I could not find.
Okay, so you can find it if you track down a website called Bandcamp.
Oh, yeah,
and
okay.
And that's an indie-friendly sort of platform for artists. But yeah, this guy, J.R. Bohannon, who is a pedal steel player from New York, and his version is very, very bittersweet. I mean, the pedal steel is such an evocative sounding instrument. I'm really, I love the way it renders melodies kind of woozy and a little bit out. And so this version really accentuates all of that stuff. It's a reminder that as much as we love like the Christmas season, there is something a little sad about it, you know, and a little bit, you know, melancholy in the way that we mark time and we mark those who are, you know, gone or aren't with us anymore. So yeah. I think that if you're the kind of person who can handle a little bittersweet, it's like a smile, but with a little sadness in your eyes, mm-hmm. that's the sense that I get from this one. Yeah. And so I really love this one.
All right. A good one to end on. Jason Patrick Woodbury, thank you so much as always. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.